We return now to looking at current nuclear power issues with Paul Gunter, who will tell us about current policies and issues on the national level. This interview is from May 17, 2006, before Paul gave his talk to the Seacoast Anti-Pollution League in Exeter, New Hampshire. This is Amy Antonucci for Making Waves. I'm speaking with Paul Gunter, Director of the Reactor Watchdog Project for the Nuclear Information and Resource Service, or NIRS, in Tacoma Park, Maryland. Paul is a longtime opponent of nuclear power, beginning with his involvement in the Clamshell Alliance here in New Hampshire to oppose the building of the Seabrook Nuclear Power Plant in the 1970s. A local group, the Seacoast Anti-Pollution League, or SAPL, invited Paul back here to New Hampshire to speak at their annual meeting on May 17th about nuclear renaissance or atomic relapse, more nuclear power plants for New Hampshire. So welcome, Paul, and thanks for speaking with us today.
Thank you very much, Amy. Appreciate it.
I'd like to start by asking you about current federal and nuclear industry plans. It's been clear that the administration is making a great effort to rejuvenate the nuclear industry. Tell us more about this.
Amy, first of all, there have been no new orders in the United States since 1978. No plant, no atomic plant ordered after 1973 was ever completed. There were 100 cancellations, many projects, even complete with billions of dollars of investment, that were canceled without ever operating the plant. So even before the Three Mile Island accident occurred in 1979, the industry had already failed the market test, and Wall Street had determined that it wasn't worth any new investment in any more plants. So essentially, the industry has been moribund with new construction since 1973. In a Forbes magazine article in 1985, nuclear power was the cover story in what was called the Nuclear Follies. And it was described by this financial advisor that nuclear power was the largest managerial disaster in business history. And nobody but the blind or the biased could ever believe that this money was well spent. And now the Bush administration, or I should say the Cheney Bush administration, is proposing that we as a society go back into this swamp. While Wall Street will not favor any new power plants at this point, it takes the federal government to basically prime the pump. So in 2005, the Bush administration lobbied Congress along with the Nuclear Energy Institute, which is the nuclear energy lobby, and they passed the energy bill of 2005. Among the many subsidies that give new meaning to the GOP, which is gas, oil, and plutonium, they've now decided to put in $13 billion of U.S. taxpayer money to jumpstart new nuclear power plants. And they're talking about constructing six new plants with federal money, basically, and to provide billions of dollars in not only direct subsidies, but billions of dollars in tax credits and federal loan guarantees, that even the Congressional Budget Office says that there's a 50-50 chance that these plants will default on these loan guarantees. And that's going to stick the taxpayer with more of what we already know to be as described as the largest managerial disaster in business history. Now they're proposing to drag us back in there when we've got better alternatives.
So because of the financial inviability of these plants, the government is going to subsidize them.
Not only that, but they're also providing a $2 billion construction insurance policy, because they know that one of the big failures was the inability of the power companies to complete constructions on time and to complete them at projected costs. They were just these huge white elephants. Seabrook was offered at $900 million for two units. Unit 2 was canceled at $900 million, and Unit 1 finally came online at over $6 billion. So these are tremendous financial sinkholes.
So much for the free market. So why are they pushing them so hard? What is the rationale they're giving, and what do you think is the reason? Do you believe their rationale?
Well, they continue to say that nuclear power is a viable energy source, despite the fact that you have to discount construction costs when they figure how much per kilowatt hour. When they say it around 2 cents a kilowatt hour or so, they're discounting the billions and billions and billions of dollars that went into construction. They're also ignoring the fact that the companies don't even have to pay for their own insurance in terms of full liability. That, again, an accident of the magnitude of Chernobyl would fall on the U.S. taxpayer. Right now, the cost of the accident at Chernobyl, which happened in 1986, stands at $400 billion. It clearly is a cost that will continue to mount for hundreds of years. The current U.S. liability cap, if such an accident were to occur in the United States, it limits the liability of nuclear power operators to $10 billion. So a very small fraction of the cost that we already know is going to be borne upon the backs of taxpayers, and in fact will probably be a cost in terms of property damage and personal suffering and disease that will never be paid, and people will simply be left to do without, much like we see what's going on right now with Katrina victims, where people have just been abandoned. A city has been abandoned. The Gulf Coast has been abandoned. So the nuclear industry right now is saying that nuclear power is the answer to global warming. But that has as much truth as when they originally offered nuclear power as the peaceful atom. And what we now know is that nuclear power is the technology for transferring nuclear weapons materials globally. And with that, the danger of nuclear war. They also promised us that it was going to be too cheap to meter. And it now is the most expensive way to boil water that man can conceive of. So there's no reason to literally buy in to nuclear power as a solution to global warming. In fact, it will divert the precious resources and the precious little time that we do have to make any abatement efforts to slow this process down for major climate change. It will divert these resources and waste our time in an effort that we already know to be a failed technology of the 1950s. And so we miss the opportunity to institute an energy policy of the 21st century, which the first and foremost step is to reduce demand through energy efficiency and conservation. We've now got 5 government laboratories here in the United States that have assessed that fully 47% of our demand can be reduced through energy efficient refrigeration, motors, lighting, air conditioning at residential, commercial, and industrial levels. And then coupling energy efficiency and conservation with renewables, such as hybrid solar and wind turbines, we have the opportunity to make that shift in cutting emissions. But central to that is reducing demand while improving our lives. And right now, the way the power industry is set up, they continue to seek to focus the power into the hands of a few, and they're not interested in saving. They're interested in generating more and more and more and wasting more and more and more. That's the corner we have to turn right now, is the tremendous political control that gas, oil, and plutonium, as the GOP, exert upon our society.
So this is another successful lobbying effort by an industry rather than an answer to a real problem.
Exactly.
The Nuclear Energy Institute has hired a few people to promote nuclear industry. One of them is Christy Todd Whitman, former New Jersey governor and head of EPA under George W. Bush, and also one of the co-founders of Greenpeace, Patrick Moore. What can you tell us about their strategy in hiring them, and particularly why someone like Patrick Moore would hop on board this effort?
You know, right now, along with this whole idea of nuclear power has suddenly become a green energy source, I think that what's being shown to be true is the only green here is the money that lines these people's pockets. Christy Todd Whitman, as soon as she quit the EPA, she became involved in her own consulting firm that basically provides facelifts to polluters, reconstructing images. One of the first clients that she had following leaving the EPA was actually to reconstruct the image for a chemical company that was involved in EPA litigation over arsenic poisoning in a community. Similarly, Patrick Moore left Greenpeace Canada in 1986 and basically began his own operation, Green Spirit Incorporated. And again, it's a private consulting firm that he heads, provides reconstructive surgery to provide facelifts for environmental polluters, including companies like Monsanto. So this is all part of a ruse, again, to paint historic polluters in a new light. There's no question that nuclear power is an incredibly polluting source. And one of the problems with both Christy Todd Whitman and Patrick Moore is that they simply distort the picture of nuclear power and try to hide the very serious environmental, security, and public health issues behind specious arguments. For example, Moore is noted for saying that no one was killed in the Three Mile Island accident. Actually, he claims that the Three Mile Island accident in 1979 was a demonstrated success. In fact, we know, even by the NRC's own records, that more than 10 million curies of radiation was released as the result of that accident. And at the time of that accident, because it was considered an incredible event that would never happen, we as a society weren't prepared for that. And so one of the areas was radiological monitoring. So there were some very large windows that were open all around the plant where there were no monitors. So in fact, people experienced a radiation poisoning, and they spoke of it. They talked about vomiting. They talked about losing hair. They talked about losing pets and livestock. There was a dentist's office who kept X-ray film in a safe and later discovered that the film had been fogged by the passing radiation cloud, as well as a study done by the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, which documents that there were cancer clusters where this radioactive cloud passed. But Moore and Christy Todd Whitman seek to gloss that over with arguments like more people have been killed with machetes than by nuclear power, and why aren't the environmentalists going out to ban machetes? It's those kinds of arguments that are designed to divert our attention.
I'd also like to hear from you about security issues and regulatory processes around that. And maybe particularly you could speak about Seabrook. I know there have been some questions and some concerns that would affect those of us right here in New Hampshire Seacoast.
Well, our organization began monitoring security issues around nuclear power stations in 1998. And the concern is that nuclear power, because it's not competitive in the electricity market, operators of nuclear power stations like Seabrook are constantly looking for ways to trim cost. One of the areas that has historically been trimmed back is site security. We became aware this concern when in 1998 it was reported by an NRC official who led a program from within the NRC that evaluated the ability of a nuclear power plant to repel an attack. And despite the fact that the companies were forewarned that they were going to be having evaluation 6 months in advance, that they were forewarned of the typically four scenarios that would be conducted that would evaluate their ability to repel an adversary, they were finding that these evaluations were succeeding at getting to a set of targets on site, such as emergency diesel generators and other safety-related equipment, 47% of the time, which would result in what this official, whose name is actually Captain David Orrick, Captain Orrick said would lead to an American Chernobyl, where a very small group of adversaries could cause a core melt accident. 47% of the time they made attempts. When the industry was faced with having to raise the defenses and the costs associated with raising defenses, they lobbied the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission to zero out this program's budget. And that's exactly what happened. After Captain David Orrick decided that he wasn't going to stand for this, President Clinton reinstituted the program, but only on a temporary basis. All the plants had not conducted even one exercise at that time. So the idea was that the evaluations would resume, and after all the plants had completed their security evaluations, the plan was to allow the plants to do self-assessments of their own security, which Captain David Orrick described as giving the failing class a take-home test. And we're talking about national security and the potential of a catastrophic accident that could poison tens of thousands of square miles. So the pilot program for this industry self-assessment was to begin in September of 2001. And on September 11th, when the World Trade Center and the Pentagon were struck by aircraft, basically the self-assessment program was scrapped. The argument was you can't conduct an exercise if you've potentially got terrorists trying to get into the site. So for at least a few years, we were without evaluations. Now there have been some upgrades as a result of September 11th. However, the plants are still not evaluated and still not protected against aircraft assault. There was a recent Government Accountability Office study that was done for Congressman Christopher Shays out of Connecticut, who asked that the GAO, you know, the investigative arm of Congress, look at the level of defenses around nuclear power stations today. And what the GAO reported is shocking, that in fact the level of security at U.S. nuclear power stations like Seabrook right now is dictated by what the U.S. nuclear power industry is willing to pay. For example, weapons that are being used by our adversaries today in Afghanistan, in Somalia, and in Iraq, you know, in energy wars around the globe, have been barred by the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission from being considered in the defense strategies for U.S. nuclear power stations like Seabrook. So, for example, today, Seabrook is not prepared and not required to defend the reactor from an assault using rocket-propelled grenades, even though these are being used every day in the global energy war. Even though the same weapon, along with another one, the 50-caliber sniper rifle, which is also available to adversaries and commonly found here domestically, the plants are not required to defend against that, and it's because the companies are simply unwilling and unable to defend at that cost. It's these kinds of figures and costs and concerns that if we were a society that was powered by energy efficiency, conservation, and renewable energy, where power systems are distributed rather than centralized, solar panels and wind turbines don't have to have armed guards. We don't have to be worried with that kind of robust and secure system, but it's not a security that requires an army to defend. It's secure in of itself as it becomes part of our homes, it becomes part of our communities, and rather than an energy source that threatens to poison us and our water and our air and our future, it's truly a power source that can renew our society.
We've been speaking today on Making Waves with Paul Gunter, director of the Reactor Watchdog Project for the Nuclear Information and Resource Service. He's been telling us about federal and nuclear industry plans to expand nuclear power. Thank you so much, Paul, for joining us.
Thank you for this opportunity, Amy.
They say it doesn't matter if the aquifer falls down 10 feet a year, as that still leaves 30 more till the final year before it is bone dry, bone dry, bone dry. But they tell you don't worry, got to hurry, 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 got to suck it up, drill it up now. And there are wise men in white lab coats gonna fix it back up somehow. They say it doesn't matter if the factory smoke stack fouls up this town's air. If it's foresight that we lack, oh, we can build a taller stack. Send it to the next town, every which way round. But they tell you don't worry, got to hurry, hurry, hurry. There's a quick buck, money, money now. And there are wise men in white lab coats gonna fix it back up somehow. They say it doesn't matter if the power plant's waste outlives us by 1,000 years. We'll be gone by then anyhow. And we want that juice right now. Leave the waste for the next ones, our granddaughters and grandsons. But they tell you don't worry, got to nuke it in a hurry, got to power those appliances now. And there are wise men in white hard hats gonna clean it back up somehow. Doesn't matter about the rainforest disappearing all around, cause there's nothing you can do but listen to the crashing sound as it falls. And don't worry, eat your burger in a hurry, gotta cut it down, chop it down now. And there are wise men in gray suit coats gonna put it back up somehow. And they say it doesn't matter if the farmer's topsoil's going, 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 gone. There are wise men in white feed caps figure out how to put it back on. And they say it doesn't matter about the hole in the sky that we're teetering on the brink. And the signs are everywhere, on the land and the sea and the air. Still they tell you don't worry, got to hurry, 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 gotta do it, gotta get it right now. Leave it to the wise men in white lab coats, they will fix it up, mess it up now. I don't wanna doomsay, don't wanna gloomsay, but I'm worried and I'm worried right now about a fragile place called Earth. How we scarce realize her worth. Would we squander her away for a thrill today, for a short-sighted quick fix now? Or will we think ahead somehow about our children's children now? And the very wise men can't leave it to them, got to take it in our own hands now. It takes the wisdom of a cow. I got to think about it, think about it, think about it, think about it, do something about it now.
That was Wise Men in White Lab Coats by Dean Stevens. You're listening to Making Waves. And now we bring you Between the Lines, independent radio out of Bridgeport, Connecticut.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present journalist Dave Lindorf and Center for Constitutional Rights attorney Barbara Olshansky, who outline the high crimes and misdemeanors committed by President Bush that they believe are grounds for his impeachment. Josh Silver, executive director of the media reform group Free Press, who explains what's at stake for the future of the Internet in the current congressional debate on network neutrality. And David Foster, executive director of the Blue-Green Alliance, who discusses the urgency of the current climate crisis and debunks the idea that Americans must choose between protecting the environment or protecting jobs. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
A joint U.S.-Iraqi military offensive in Ramadi, Iraq, an insurgent-controlled city of 400,000 people, has begun. The military operation was the culmination of weeks of action by coalition troops to seal off the city, creating the fear of another Fallujah-style siege. In recent days, the United Nations reported 10,000 people have fled Ramadi, and daily life has grown increasingly harsh. American military units control all access points into the Sunni-majority city and have created a series of outposts near insurgent strongholds, seeking to cut off supplies and arm flows to fighters. Prior to the military offensive, insurgents in Ramadi openly walked around without fear of retaliation by American or Iraqi troops. In January, insurgents in the city killed 70 police recruits and later assassinated half a dozen tribal leaders. As Sheikh Fasil Gaoud, the former governor of the province of Al-Anbar, which includes Ramadi, told the Los Angeles Times, the situation is catastrophic. No services, no electricity, no water. People in Ramadi are caught between two plagues, the vicious armed insurgents and American and Iraqi troops. The Interpress Service reports Sudan's Islamic government is taking a hard line against deployment of a 20,000-strong United Nations peacekeeping force. The setback comes only weeks after the Khartoum government signed a peace deal brokered by the United States with the rebel Sudanese Liberation Army. Other rebel factions have refused to sign the accord. Sudan's Minister of Foreign Affairs, El Samani El Wasili, said, "Our position is against any foreign interference in Darfur. The UN troops will complicate rather than solve things." Sudan supports the currently deployed 7,000-member African Union Monitoring Force, which oversees an area the size of Texas. Since the conflict started in Darfur 3 years ago, more than 300,000 people have been killed and more than 2 million people were displaced from their homes. The Bush administration has called the situation in Darfur genocide. Human rights groups are pushing for a UN peacekeeping force. As David Mazursky of the International Crisis Group observed, the Sudanese government is fearful that a strong UN force in Darfur will lead to the arrest of people in the government who have been mentioned by the International Criminal Court to have been involved in war crimes. For the second time, federal judge Janet Hall has issued an injunction against the Bridgeport, Connecticut Police Department for harassing participants in a city needle exchange program. The new order issued on May 30th called for the Bridgeport police to stop arresting people involved in the needle exchange for having injection equipment, such as syringes, cotton, and cookers used for injecting controlled substances. A civil suit filed by the American Civil Liberties Union on behalf of individual plaintiffs and the Connecticut Harm Reduction Coalition alleged Bridgeport police officers searched for injection equipment that was permitted under state law and violated the Fourth Amendment to the U.S. Constitution against unlawful searches. Judge Hall expanded her 2001 injunction order. It specifically prohibits Bridgeport police from stopping, searching, arresting anyone with 30 or fewer sets of injection devices. As Adam Wolf, an attorney with the ACLU's Drug Reform Project, stated, public health should be placed above punitive posturing. Nationally, a third of all HIV/AIDS infections in adults are caused by intravenous drug use. According to the National Institute of Health, needle exchange programs can reduce HIV infections up to 30%. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Ruben Abreu.
President Bush's standing in public opinion polls hovering around 37%, according to a mid-June NBC News Wall Street Journal poll, this November's midterm congressional election could be decisive in moving the nation in a new direction. The Republicans who control both houses of Congress are unwilling to hold the president and his administration accountable for many actions that have raised questions about White House abuse of power. No serious investigations have been held into allegations that the president lied America into war with Iraq, violations of international law, including the holding of detainees without charge or trial, and the torture of prisoners in U.S. custody, war profiteering, illegal surveillance of U.S. citizens, and the government's failure to assist victims of Hurricane Katrina. Often citing the September 11th terrorist attacks as justification, President Bush has used his power as commander-in-chief to authorize extraordinary measures in the U.S. and abroad that a growing number of observers believe violate the Constitution. A Zogby poll conducted in January found that 52% of those surveyed supported impeachment if President Bush engaged in unlawful warrantless spying on U.S. citizens. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with journalist Dave Lindorf and Center for Constitutional Rights attorney Barbara Olshansky, who was representing the 300 detainees at the U.S. prison in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. Together, they are the authors of the book, The Case for Impeachment, The Legal Argument for Removing President George W. Bush from Office. Lindorf and Olshansky outline what they maintain are high crimes and misdemeanors committed by President Bush that they believe are grounds for his impeachment.
We have five chapters of impeachable violations all documented, and we only went for the ones that we thought were solid cases that could be traced directly to the president. So therefore, we didn't, for example, include election fraud because nobody's really been able to lay that at the president's door clearly. And I can just run down the list. I sort of recategorized them into about nine areas. One is the initiating a war of aggression against a nation that posed no immediate threat to the U.S. and organizing a conspiracy to trick the American people and Congress into an illegal war. Both of those are, by the way, the highest war crime you can commit. They're called crimes against peace and a conspiracy for a crime against peace under the Nuremberg Charter, which is also a crime under U.S. law because the U.S. adopted the Geneva Conventions. The second one is approving and encouraging, in violation of U.S. and international law, the use of torture, kidnapping, and extraordinary rendering of prisoners of war captured in Iraq and Afghanistan and in the course of the so-called War on Terror. The third is illegally stripping the right of citizenship and protection of the Constitution from American citizens, denying them the fundamental right to have their cases heard in court, to hear the charges against them, to be judged in public court by a jury of their peers, to have access to a lawyer, and so on. The fourth is authorizing the spying on American citizens and their communications by the National Security Agency and other U.S. police and intelligence agencies in violation of the First and Fourth Amendments and the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. Fifth is obstructing investigation into and covering up knowledge of the deliberate exposing of the identity of a U.S. CIA undercover operative and possibly conspiring in that initial outing itself. Six is obstructing the investigation into the 9/11 attacks and lying to investigators from the Congress and the bipartisan 9/11 Commission. These are actions that come perilously close to treason. Number seven is violating the due process and other constitutional rights of thousands of citizens and legal residents by rounding them up and disappearing or deporting them without hearings. Number eight is abuse of power, undermining the Constitution, and the violation of the presidential oath of office by deliberately refusing to administer over 750 acts duly passed into law by Congress, actions that, if left unchallenged, would make the Congress a vestigial body and the president a dictator. And finally, criminal negligence in failing to provide American troops with adequate armor before sending them into war of choice, criminal negligence in going to war against a weak third world nation without any planning for post-war occupation and reconstruction, criminal negligence in failing to respond to a known and growing crisis in the storm-blasted city of New Orleans, and criminal negligence, finally, in failing to act and, in fact, actively obstructing efforts by other countries and American state governments to deal with the looming crisis of global warming. So that's a pretty good list of serious crimes.
It seems that you have many in the leadership of the Democratic Party downplaying the whole idea of impeachment. I know House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi basically says, you know, this is going to backfire on us if we talk about impeachment before the election, that this will only serve to energize the Republican hardcore right-wing base that will come out to the polls motivated by the fact that they don't want to see their president impeached.
The Democrats, especially the leadership Democrats, including Pelosi and Reid, are totally out of touch with the Democratic base, and I think they're even afraid of the Democratic base. The really pathetic thing about this is that they're afraid that impeachment will rally the Republican base. When is the last time that the Democrats have even tried to rally their own base? And it seems clear to us that impeachment it will do exactly that. It will rally the Democratic base. Zogby poll found that as many as 80% of Democrats think that the president should be impeached, and 53% of all Americans, a clear majority of independents, think that. So the Democrats are nuts if they don't make impeachment a centerpiece for the November elections.
Your thoughts on that, Barbara?
I just have the most basic response, I think, to people like Nancy Pelosi and others, which is, how could you possibly be afraid of making these arguments when they are the arguments that created this country? They represent the courage that the founders of this country had to bring about a great democracy. And all we're saying is, you know, have the faith, have the courage to do again what they did, to stand up to a president that disregards the Constitution and disregards what the Supreme Court says and disowns the treaties that it has made with the rest of the world. And my goodness, if we, the people, ever owned the moral high ground in this discourse, it is right now in history. You know, that language, we the people, what does it mean in terms of accountability? For me, you know, working on the Guantanamo case has just been, you know, this incredible eye-opening experience about how far the United States is willing to go from its own military law, from humanitarian law and the most basic human rights law. And it didn't matter that when we won in the Supreme Court, that the people on our sides were generals and admirals who were saying to Bush, don't do this. Don't disregard the Geneva Conventions. This is the promise we made to humanity. And what we ended up seeing was a nightmare, and a nightmare that got exported from Guantanamo to Iraq.
That was Dave Lindorf and Barbara Olshansky, authors of the book, The Case for Impeachment, The Legal Argument for Removing President George W. Bush from Office. For more reading on The Case for Impeachment, visit Dave Lindorf's website at www.thiscan'tbehappening.net. Telecommunications giants, including AT&T, Verizon, and Comcast, are now engaged in a multi-million-dollar lobbying campaign to change the rules governing the Internet. These companies are pressuring the GOP-controlled Congress to scrap something called network neutrality, which its supporters say guarantees that web content providers of all sizes will all have equal access to reaching a worldwide audience. However, telecom companies are eager to set up a new system where only those websites that can afford to pay high access fees can reach their audience with state-of-the-art speed and reliability. Standing in opposition to the phone and cable company's plan is the politically diverse Save the Internet Coalition. Groups from the left and right, such as MoveOn.org, Common Cause, the Christian Coalition, and Gun Owners of America, have come together in the coalition to preserve net neutrality and freedom in cyberspace. Joining in their campaign are giant internet companies like Google, Yahoo, and Microsoft. On June 8th, the GOP-controlled U.S. House of Representatives passed the Communications Opportunity, Promotion, and Enhancement Act without enforceable net neutrality provisions. The debate now moves to the U.S. Senate, where the Save the Internet Coalition recently delivered over 1 million petition signatures demanding the protection of net neutrality. One Senate bill that would do this is the bipartisan Internet Freedom and Preservation Act. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Josh Silver, executive director of the media reform group Free Press, who explains what's at stake in the congressional debate on the future of the Internet.
What's happening now is the phone and cable companies are trying to pass a law in the U.S. Congress that would make it so that they can essentially privatize the Internet, so that they can set up toll booths along the Internet. They can decide who gets to be seen, how fast it'll be delivered, the content that is coming through the web, and how much it will cost. It's a profound change to the Internet that really would undermine everything that is great about the Internet, the innovation, the neutrality, the democratic platform, the every voice is equal principle, and make it so that only a handful of corporations would be able to achieve rapid download and upload speeds and essentially turn the internet into a modern version of cable television.
Josh Silver, who are the big players here? Who's fighting this out?
Well, it's really interesting. I mean, what we have here are basically the bad guys are the cable and phone companies and a series of what we call AstroTurf or sort of fake grassroots groups that they fund. The good guys in this case are all the public interest groups. And interestingly, an incredible sort of strange bedfellow alliance of public interest groups as diverse as the Gun Owners of America and the Christian Coalition standing next to MoveOn.org and the National Organization for Women and our organization, Free Press. So there's a very broad ideological network of support for this principle of net neutrality and keeping the internet free. And then on the industry side, that's been fascinating. They're good guys here, Google, eBay, Yahoo, even Microsoft, the American Electronics Association, TechNet. These are associations that are usually very anti-regulation. They've come in with the good guys on this one. So what we're seeing right now is we lost the vote in the U.S. House of Representatives last week. It was actually embarrassing, 321 to 101. But it was for more reasons than just the obvious, which is that the telcos have such a powerful lobby. We sort of knew we would lose. But what we're seeing now is all eyes have shifted to the Senate, where the Senate is being literally deluged by tens of millions of dollars being spent every week by the telephone companies, particularly, on this issue. And it's going to play out over the next couple of weeks.
What legislation is now being considered in the Senate in regard to net neutrality?
What we're seeing is a bill that is moving through the Senate that is going to look very different than the bill that passed in the House. And what we think is that in the joint House-Senate conference, and that's when the House members and the Senate members get together behind closed doors and work quietly amongst themselves to try to reconcile the differences in the bill, that we believe that in that process, that it's going the bills are going to be so different that it will be impossible for them to move out and on and back onto the floor of the House and Senate for passage. The real hope is that if enough people raise their voices and say no to this, that we'll be able to kill this bill in the current Congress, and the phone companies will have to come back next year and try again. So far, we've had over 1 million people submit petitions and make phone calls to Congress, and we've seen a coalition of over 720 groups come in support of net neutrality. It's been really extraordinary. So that's the goal, and I think the odds are with us, but only if lots of people, lots more people go to savetheinternet.com, sign the petition, make calls to Congress, get involved, because if we don't see that happen in the next few days, we might well lose this.
That was Josh Silver, Executive Director of the media reform group Free Press. Contact Free Press toll-free at 1-866-666-1533 or visit the SaveTheInternet.com website. In early June, America's largest private sector manufacturing union and the country's largest environmental organization declared a strategic alliance to pursue a joint public policy agenda under the banner of good jobs, a clean environment, and a safer world. The United Steelworkers of America, 850,000 strong, and the Sierra Club, with its 750,000 members, are joining forces as the Blue-Green Alliance. The alliance began informally almost 10 years ago around the meetings to set up the Kyoto Protocol to reduce global warming gases. Of specific concern was the impact global warming could have on jobs and the economy. Only about 12% of steelworkers' union members work in the steel industry, but 80% work in various kinds of heavy industry and 20% are service workers. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with David Foster, the new executive director of the Blue-Green Alliance. Foster was formerly the District 11 director of the United Steelworkers, which stretches from Minnesota to the far west. He discusses the urgency of the current climate crisis and debunks the idea that Americans must choose between protecting the environment or protecting jobs.
We think there's a direct connection between changing the energy basis of our economy from an old fossil fuel burning economy to a new renewable energy economy based on energy efficiency. So we believe that we will be supporting state and local initiatives around the country to push for renewable energy standards, to push for clean car laws such as have been passed out in California, Washington, and Oregon, and drawing the connections between these environmental initiatives that deal with global warming and the creation of a whole new generation of manufacturing jobs in the United States.
Would any of your workers stand to lose their jobs if you were successful in moving to this different economy you're talking about? And would they then be able to take advantage of the new jobs? It's sort of like the old jobs versus the environment argument.
Our union has believed for a long time that this argument about jobs versus the environment presents a bunch of false choices, and that the reality, as we've seen it unfold over the last 25 years, is that it's not jobs versus the environment, it's both or neither. And over again, as we've watched the global economy unfold, what we've found is that the companies and plants where there have been significant environmental advances and investments made, those are the plants and companies that survive. And the plants and companies that insist on turning a blind eye to pollution, to global warming, and so forth, those are the companies and businesses that have gone out of business. And so we think it's strategically the smart thing to do to get on the right side of history and promote good environmental practices, renewable energy, energy efficiency, and those companies that heed our call are the companies that are going to survive. We've watched this play out in industry after industry, and currently, unfortunately, we're watching great problems in the U.S. automotive industry precisely because they've been on the wrong side of fuel efficiency and the changing nature of automotive transportation in the world today, and we don't intend to stand by and let that happen to other sectors of the manufacturing economy in the United States.
What about the auto industry? Can the Blue-Green Alliance do anything to save it from itself?
Well, sure. A lot of our members work in auto parts manufacturing companies. They make tires for all the vehicles that are produced in the United States. We're very concerned about the future of the automotive industry in this country, as every American ought to be. And I think one of the things that we hope to promote is that there is a market in America for hybrid automobiles, for fuel-efficient transportation, for mass transportation, for all these solutions that deal with global warming based on promoting alternative energy and fuel efficiency. And so when we go around to the cities, as we're planning on our New Vision for America tour, to meet with mayors and hold town hall meetings who are in support of the Climate Protection Agreement, what we're going to be pointing out is that by buying hybrid vehicles, by searching for renewable energy, sources of energy and technology, we are creating jobs, and we can create a new automotive industry in this country that's based on meeting those needs. So I think regardless of what the Detroit management of the U.S. auto industry thinks, that the American consumer is knowledgeable and understands what the future demands, and we just want to bring the automotive industry along with us.
Dave Foster, have you seen An Inconvenient Truth, Al Gore's movie about global warming?
Yes, I have.
What did you think of it?
Well, I think it's a terrific movie, and I really applaud Gore for having taken on this issue and taken it on with the seriousness that it deserves, and I think it will do a lot to add to the debate in the country today, especially dispelling this idea that there is any uncertainty about the science of global warming. What I find most troublesome in the current debate about global warming is our inability to talk about how environmental and economic sustainability, while they are completely linked, what's preventing us from dealing with them is our refusal to take on the social justice element that underlies this problem. And by that I mean, when we live in a world of 6.5 billion people in which 2 billion of them are living on less than $2 a day, we simply can't change that model and create an economy that's based on both environmental and economic sustainability without dealing with this endemic problem of global poverty. We've created a model of enormous wealth and enormous poverty in the world today precisely because we don't believe in economic and environmental sustainability as being linked. If we're going to solve this problem of global warming, we have to link those two issues to sustainability. We can't do it without dealing with the issues of social justice as well. And that's one thing that I thought was missing from the movie, and I think is what the Blue-Green Alliance and what the Steelworkers and Sierra Clubs share in common, which is so fundamentally important, and it's the values of the voice we bring to this debate.
That was David Foster, Executive Director of the Blue-Green Alliance. Call the Alliance at area code 612-623-8003 or visit the group's website at www.bluegreenalliance.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at www.btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Ruben Abreu, Bill Cosentino, Chris Ferriero, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.
Thanks for listening to Making Waves, independent voices for peace and justice. The Making Waves crew is Amy Antonucci, Steve Capron, Steve Diamond, Tom Jackson, Stanley Longstaff, Joanne Paradise, and Damon Thomas. We welcome your participation too. Please email us at nhmakingwaves@yahoo.com to get involved. Our theme music is by New Hampshire women's drum group Tabalat, and our mid-show music is Evening Stars by Alice Gomez. You can live stream our show on Saturdays from 2 to 4 if you're not in range of the station by going to www.wirenh.com. Remember that WSCA is growing and hoping for your membership and participation. www.wscafm.org to join and learn more. Tune in next Saturday from 2 to 4 for our next Making Waves program. We'll be exploring the American way a few days before July 4th. We leave you now with this quote by the poet Walt Whitman. Resist much, obey little.